noise!
How you doing, everyone? I'm Russ Salzberg, and once again, I want you all to listen up and get a load of this. Smokin' Joe Frazier was one of the great heavyweight champions of all time. His three fights with Muhammad Ali, of course, are legendary. But who was the real Joe Frazier? There's a great new book out now by author Mark Cram Jr. that tells us. So like I said, listen up. I mean, really listen up, because you're really going to want to get a load of this. All right, folks. As I said, the title of the book is Smokin' Joe, The Life of Joe Frazier. And I'm telling you, and believe me, there's nothing in this for me. I couldn't put this book down. It is not just about Joe Frazier, the champ. It's about Joe Frazier, the man. And no ifs, ands, or buts about it. Author Mark Cram Jr. here delivers what I call a knockout. It is just a tremendous... I mean, if you love boxing, and especially if you love that era when Smokin' Joe was fighting Muhammad Ali and everybody else, you're going to love this book. So without further ado, let me welcome in author Mark Cram Jr. Mark, thanks so much for being here.
I'm delighted to be with you, Russ. Thank you.
Listen, I meant, when I got the book from, you know, your publisher, I couldn't put it down. You know, I thought I was just going to skim through it and pick up some things, but it was just... It had everything. So much so, it even had emotion. So let me start off by maybe asking you a twofold question.
Sure.
Why did you choose Joe as a subject to do a book? And then back end of that would be, and why at this point? Why now?
Well, right. I just thought he lived a fascinating life. He grew up amid the poverty of Beaufort, South Carolina, which in the 40s and 50s was just about as impoverished as any place in the country. There's malnutrition, disease running rampant, and the Jim Crow laws were firmly established down there. And, you know, he just, when you think of his life, you know, as I started to investigate it somewhat. It was almost like he was standing in the bottom of a well, looking up at the night sky at the furthest star. That's how far he had to go in life, and he did it. He took the bus to New York at age 15, and as part of the African American migration from the South. And he was on the wrong side of the law when he was in New York stealing cars and ended up in the gyms in Philadelphia. And it's just a fascinating journey, Russ. And, you know, and it hadn't been told. It had been told in piecemeal, but not in any comprehensive way. And I wanted to uncouple him from his main rival, of course, Muhammad Ali, and tell Joe's story, not Joe's story through Ali, if you follow me.
Yeah. Also, what I found interesting, and I guess that's part of, you know, how you got into this, is that your dad was quite an accomplished writer covering boxing for Sports Illustrated.
Right. Dad was a giant in the sports writing business in the 60s, the golden age of Sports Illustrated, back when Sports Illustrated was sort of on everybody's in everybody's mailbox. And Dad covered boxing. He covered all three Ali Frazier fights, and really distinguished himself as one of the real true talents of his generation. And you know, I was around it a bit as a kid, but I had no intention of really following in doing a biography of Joe Frazier. In fact, I had resisted it on several occasions. But at the time, it seemed like, you know, time was passing. Joe had died in 2011, and now here we were in 2016, and I was thinking, wow, if somebody doesn't do it now, who's going to do it? You know, most of the people that were in his generation were dying off, and his closest friends and family, So I wanted to get to them and sort of put it on the record, if you follow me.
Yeah, I will say this. One of the things that you mentioned where he came from, the poverty, the extreme poverty in Beaufort, South Carolina, and reading it, I mean, you know, and naturally, I'm from that era. You know, to me, that was the glory era of boxing, especially the heavyweight ranks, because it wasn't just Ali Frazier and the Ken Nortons and Larry Holmes after that, and you know, the guys that they fought, Ron Lyle and Ernie Shaver, you know, Jerry Quarry, you can go on and on. But what really struck me, you know, I've always said this, and, you know, just from reading your words, I think you would agree, you know, fighters, they have to come from the mean streets. You know, you can teach me to be aggressive. You can teach kids to want it and to go get it. But the one thing that I always say, you can't teach hunger. If you've never tasted it, it's not something that you can go and know what it tastes like. You know, hunger, it's poverty. And, you know, that's why fighters have to come from those streets. But here we were thinking, for example, listen, Muhammad Ali, Cassius Clay before that, wasn't brought up, you know, in some great...
He was better off than Joe.
Oh, he certainly... He's compared to Joe, he was brought up like a king. I mean, when you think about it, he was the youngest... Reading your comments, he was the youngest of 13 children. And he almost didn't make it because his father... you know, besides working in the sharecropping and what, and, you know, was doing some moonshining, and a guy comes alongside who was a rival and shoots him with a shotgun, blows his arm off, and it sprays his mom, who was pregnant with Joe at the time.
That's right. It could have been, he could have been out of the game early at that point. Right. It was, they were outside of a party, and there was a lot of drinking going on, and there was a rival bootlegger, and I think it was a scrape over or a beef over a woman, and the guy shot Reuben Frazier through this car window, and he lost his hand, actually Dolly had some bullets fragments in her foot. Whenever it got cold, she would, or you know, when it would rain, she would feel that bullet moving around there. So really, it was, you know, he was very much on the margins of life. In fact, off the margins at that time. Nobody would have given him any chance to make anything of his life, much less become heavyweight champion.
Yeah, but so then, you know, he gets to New York. As you say, was getting in trouble, ends up in Philadelphia, and fast forward a little bit, you know, they see that, you know, some people, and Yank Durham, his trainer, they see that there's something there, they get 40 people, 40 local businessmen, to chip in $20,000 to underwrite, you know, what would become Cloverleigh, which was the group that backed him, and his career was launched. And the irony of that is Muhammad Ali had a bunch of Louisville businessmen pretty much do the same thing for him.
Right. Ali called him his 11 white millionaires.
Yes.
That he called him. But Joe, just to back up just a bit, Russ, he had gotten to the gym when he came to Philadelphia. His sister had told him, look, if you get in trouble down here, there's nothing I can do for you. Why don't you go over to the 23rd PAL, the Police Athletic League, and, you know, get to know the police, and, you know, they can help you. And he was about 30 pounds overweight, couldn't fit any of his clothes, had no direction. He said, sure, why not? He had to lose some weight anyway. But he got to the gym, and they saw him hit the heavy bag. And it was one of the trainers who was there that day told me, he said he hit with such a crack. He hit the bag with such a force, you could hear it across the street. I mean, you know, it must have been like, you know, when you hear Jimmy Fox or Ted Williams hit a baseball, you know, it's a singular sound. And he was good enough to make it to the Olympics. He found his way, won the gold medal. but he had trouble getting going as a pro. He was too small for a heavyweight. Nobody figured that he would amount to much. You know, he just didn't have the size and what have you. And of course, the Philadelphians stepped forward. It was almost like a civic kind of investment, and you had to be from Pennsylvania to invest in him. You know, Russ. It was like a stock that was limited to Philadelphia or Pennsylvania residents. George Romney, who was the Michigan governor and father of Mitt Romney, he loved Joe, and he was always calling to see if he could, you know, buy some stock or shares of stock in Joe. Couldn't do it.
Hmm. You know, you mentioned his size, and Joe wasn't 6 feet tall.
No.
He was 5'11", but this, to me, I found fascinating. They were doing, I believe it was for the second Liston Alley fight. There was some kind of phone link-up, and for you to have this in a book, I thought that was marvelous, because I had never heard anything like this.
Right.
They, you know, they each were having a conversation with Joe, Ali and Sonny Liston.
Right.
And he was asking for advice. And Ali, in all seriousness, said to him, "You should be a light heavyweight."
Yeah.
I mean, when you hear that remark, and then you think of the three legendary fights, one and three in particular, you know, the fight of the century and the thrill in Manila, and you say to myself, you know, this is one tough son of a bitch to become Ali said you should be a light heavyweight.
But don't you think, Russ, that Ali was already then beginning the psychological warfare?
Yes. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Sort of. He was always trying to get in Joe's kitchen. I mean, I guess he did it with all his opponents, right? So he was always trying to put you on the back of your heels that way.
Kind of interesting, though. That's you kind of open up the garage door for me. I think he did get into his kitchen, but he got into his kitchen in a way that when you read it and you read some, I'm not going to say everything that you have in the book, but when you read some of the remarks and, you know, calling a guy, a fellow black man, a gorilla, and you're so ugly, and you're this, and you're uneducated, and stuff like that. When you know the kind of guy and where he came from, Joe Frazier, that is, you could see how that didn't sit well, as if, you know, and he was, listen, at a time in the 60s in America where the country was divided, his own race, you know, they were going for, you know, African-Americans were going for Muhammad Ali, and Joe Frazier became the enemy, if you will.
Well, it's very true. And if you recall at that time, and I know you do, people were choosing up sides based on the race, the draft, a lot of social issues. It became kind of a test where depending upon what fighter, whose camp you were in, it told you a lot about who you were, right? Ali, it's a kind of an interesting thing. He was a genius, as everyone knows, of self-promotion, mm-hmm. right? I mean, his mind was going 100 miles a minute. You know, how could he promote his fights? How could he promote himself?
He was the best.
It was unbelievable. Bobby Goodman, famed publicist, told me that they were down in Houston one time, and I forget exactly what fight it was, but he ticket sales were lagging, and Goodman said Ali would run into his room, his motel room. He said, "I got a great idea," right? Well, one day he came in and says, "Here's what we'll do. We'll pretend I got kidnapped, take me up to a cabin, leave me there 3 days, and then we'll discover me, and then it'll make headlines all across the world." Right? Bobby said, "Well, we can't do that, of course." But that's sort of indicative of how Ali's mind always worked. It was always working. But with Joe, he upped the ante. You know, it got racial, it got ugly, Joe was a big-hearted, likable guy. You treat him well, he treat you well, right? That was how he looked at life. But with Ali, you know, he was actually always turning the screw. And, you know, with his, I know you remember the scene in the book where he's up at Deer Lake.
Yep.
And he comes out of the, finishes his workout and addresses his the fans that are there, probably about 100 people, mostly suburban white men and women who had come up to see him work out. And he's starting, he says, "I am the greatest." He starts his rap. And nobody, they're all sitting on their hands. Nobody's really reacting much. And then he starts in on the gorilla.
Yeah,
and it was ugly.
I mean, what he was spewing was real. You know what? It was back then. It was disgusting at any time.
Oh, yeah. And the piece was written, a marvelous piece by Nick Cohen, the writer in New York Magazine, which is where I drew the scene from. The title of the story was Alley Racist. It was full. I mean, I'm just skimming the surface here about what Ali said, but what was even more interesting is how the fans that were there, the might, you know, they're talking about Joe being ignorant and, just, it went on and on and on. And you could just imagine how that would play today, right, Russ? I mean, forget about it.
It wouldn't be allowed today. But, I mean, you know, everything from, you know what? Just because you mentioned it, I got the book in front of me. Gorilla said Ali one more time. He said Frazier was so ugly he should donate his face to the wildlife fund. So ugly that mirrors paid him not to look into them. Ugly, ugly, ugly. How could we have a gorilla for a champion? What would the people in Manila think? The people all over the world, that all Americans look like that, that all black brothers were animals, ignorant, stupid, ugly. If Frazier stood as our champion, what would other nations think of us? I mean, that's pretty hard shit, for lack of a better term.
And what did just read on a little bit, what did the woman in the front row say? I mean, didn't they say something else kind of like sick or deranged or something? I forget exactly.
Degenerate, said the
degenerates.
Right on, said Ali. Freaks.
Freaks.
And the crowd loved every moment, jammed tight in their rows. They rocked and stamped their feet, roared at each new Sally. And when you think about that, what struck me about it was a couple of things. So here is this guy being portrayed this way. And listen, Ali is Muhammad Ali. He's a legendary figure in America, not just as a fighter, but, you know, humanitarian, what have you. However, I've always said this about Muhammad Ali, that I always called him, I shouldn't say I always, as I got older and then I read a few things, the accidental hero. And the reason I said that, you know, you being an author, I don't know if you ever read it. There was a marvelous book out. So last year, a couple of years ago, Blood Brothers, The Fatal Friendship Between Muhammad Ali and Malcolm X. And the two guys wrote it. I don't remember their names, but it's clear as day. You know, nobody ever challenged it that, you know, Ali, he didn't go in the draft, not because he didn't want to go in the draft. He was flat out afraid that the Nation of Islam, you know, Elijah Muhammad, he was afraid he was going to kill him. I mean, he said it to Sugar. He was going to fight. It was going to be his last fight before, you know, being suspended. And he was fighting Zora Foley.
Right.
And Sugar Ray Robinson, the great Sugar Ray Robinson, knew something was up, that he wasn't right. He knocked on his door at 2 o'clock in the morning. He says, "What's the matter?" He says, "Well, I can't go into service." And Sugar Ray said, what do you mean you can't go in? It's a snap. You go in like Joe Louis went in, like I went in, you fight a few fights, you're out and that's it. And he says, "No, I can't do that." And he was afraid he was going to get killed. And then years later, he was in Louisville. And very well-known sports writer Dave Kindred was talking to him, and he said the same thing, that I can't leave because I'm afraid. The quote was, "They're going to do to me what they did to Malcolm."
Well, you know, his fears were justified.
Yeah, yes, they were.
Temper of the times, and what was going on in the country at the time. You know, there's been a lot of debate and speculation on the whys and wherefores of Ali's resistance of the draft. And I think that he was improvisational outside the ring as he was inside the ring. He would go with a story and follow it up, and if it got a reaction that seemed to be in keeping with his you know, how he wanted the things to play out, then he would go with it. So he was a master at that, and certainly it was true with how he treated Joe over the course of years. And you know, Joe was mystified by the whole thing. He just didn't understand. You know, boxers, Russ, have a fraternity outside the ring.
Yes,
they
do.
They may beat the crap out of each other inside the ring, but once they get outside the ring, you know, they really look after each other. And the Ali Frazier relationship was always kind of in, you know, Ali irritated Joe. I mean, there was that scene in the book where in Philly, you know, Ali moved into Philadelphia during his exile, right into Joe's backyard. And he was always showing up, pestering Joe in one way or another in public. And almost as if he was trying to take over the town. Well, it got to one point where Joe was getting some musical equipment for a gig at the Academy of Music, and out of his trunk, and Ali shows up marching down the street with 50 followers behind him, screaming at Joe, shouting his name, and Joe reached for a tire iron. He was so furious. Two people who were with him that day confirmed that story. He had bullets. He was sweating bullets. You know, I doubt he would have hit him, but I think that he was
incensed.
He was incensed. He was absolutely incensed by what Ali was pulling in his hometown, on his home turf.
Well, to prove, though, your point of that it's a fraternity amongst fighters, though, here he was. Forget, we haven't even got into the ring yet, but here he was taking it on a chin from Ali out of the ring, being, you know, having to take all this crap and, you know, whether it was for show or not. You know, this was Ali. Listen. Let them both rest in peace. Muhammad Ali, hey, he had a lot of P.T. Barnum in him. He knew how to sell, and he knew if a sucker was born. But despite all this, despite all the vitriol that he was spewing at Joe Frazier, when he was on the balls of his ass, down on his luck, when he wasn't making money, here was Joe Frazier giving him money. Cash, giving him money to make ends meet? I mean, what kind of man does that tell you that Joe Frazier was?
Well, that was Joe, and that was one of the revelations in the book, Russ. He did it not just for Ali behind the scenes. He used to carry a roll of bills in his
yep.
sock.
Yep.
It was called The Love.
The you love. Know, cash, like we call it's Gelt, Schkarol, Mula, this and that. No, him, it was the love. Am I right?
Yes, that's right, the love. And if he came upon you and you looked like you needed help, there's a scene in the book, early in the book, him encountering a man in a legless man in a wheelchair.
Oh, tremendous.
On a cold December day, and I won't, you know, tell the whole story, but how he gets, he picks the guy up, drives him home, and it's around Christmas time, and he peels off a couple, peels off the roll to give him some money. The guy couldn't believe it, you know, but, you know, he would, if you were stranded on the side of the road and you had a flat tire and Joe happened by, he would pull over and change it for you. He didn't do that once, he did again and again. I mean, he was a good guy.
I guess what made him a good guy is that he really never forgot where he came from. You know, he liked to hang out Because he was always into cars. He was into cars, fixing them himself. He liked to hang out at junkyards and stuff.
Yeah, right.
No, but he knew everybody. He liked doing that. He liked schmoozing, if you will.
Oh, yeah.
He liked being in the neighborhood. He was a neighborhood guy in Philadelphia.
He was a man of the people.
Yeah.
He really was. To his credit, Ali was as well.
Without question. Yeah.
I mean, Ali was, he did tremendous acts of generosity that the public never found out about Ali. These guys, here's what it is, Russ. These guys, and Joe is in Philly, they understood what it meant to be the champ, right? Remember what it meant to be the champ back in the day.
Oh.
I mean, if you had the champ in town, these guys knew how to wear that mantle, you know? You think about today.
Stop. Don't even get there, right? Tyson Fury fought the other night. Tyson who? The heavyweights today, and I've always said this, the heavyweights today are just big. They're making them like, okay, you're 6'6", you're 6'8". They're not the heavyweights that we grew up with.
They barely know how to hold up their hands.
Right.
It's really kind of disgusting. Well, but the point is that to be the champ, that was something. And, you didn't have to go through a PR man or set up an appointment to see Joe. All you had to go is down the North Broad Street and walk into his gym. He had all the time in the world for you. And especially young people. He understood he was always grateful to the cops for helping him and showing them the way. You know, he told me the last time I saw Joe, 2009, he said, young people, kids need to know that somebody cares about them. He believed that sincerely. That's what he lived by. And so he understood what it was to be the champ. He was comfortable in that role.
Did you have, obviously your dad was in the business. Were you able to go with your dad to some of Joe's fights?
Well, the first fight was '74. I was a 17-year-old kid. I was at the end of the school year holiday. Dad brought me to New York for the second Quarry fight, Frazier Quarry. And, so it was the first boxing match I had ever seen live. It was, Madison Square Garden. What a big deal that was. I was supposed to sit in Telly Savalas' seats. I mean, they were going to give me his seat, but Telly showed up with a date, so I was bounced back to the cheap seats. But it was really kind of a great experience. But, you know, I became a sports writer myself. I followed in kind of Dad's footsteps, and I became a sports writer at the Philadelphia Daily News in 1987. So I got to know Joe from then until Joe's death in 2011. I left the Daily News in 2013, but to write books. But I got to know him. I got to know how the city responded and reacted to him, and I really felt that there was a deeper story to be told here with Joe. And I'm glad I did. It was really worth the time and effort.
Oh, without question. And again, folks, we're talking about Smokin' Joe Frazier. The Life of Joe Frazier by Mark Cram Jr., who is with us now. We've been speaking about stuff out of the ring. How about in the ring? I mean, and there's so many fights and wars, but when you talk about the trilogy, the three fights that he had with Ali, I mean, my goodness. I think what gets lost in all that, because they were so monumental. Listen, a few years back, if you're a boxing fan, for example, there was the Arturo Gatti, Mickey Ward trilogy. They were three great fights, but we're talking about welterweights, and they weren't champs. They might have been champs at different times, but they weren't remotely the best of their era or anything like that. They were just two classic warriors. But
the other piece of it is everybody had a piece of Ali and Frazier. It was not everybody was watching.
Right.
Yeah.
But you're talking about three wars of men who were heavyweights.
Oh yeah.
That's the difference. Heavyweights. Listen, We can talk about Sugar Ray Leonard and Hearns and Hearns and Hagler and Duran, but these guys were heavyweights.
Oh, yeah.
Who didn't go backwards.
That's right. Joe, I don't think Joe took a backward step his whole career. I really don't. He was always coming at you, always coming at you. And I think Ali had fear of him, you know, inside those ropes. I really do. I think Joe scared the daylights out of Ali. Ali, to his credit, was a courageous champion who really knew, who really changed that fear into a positive force. But he knew he was in with a really tough guy.
That first fight, and I clearly thought Frazier won that fight, but afterwards, Frazier was in the hospital for 12 days. I mean, 12 days. And as you point out, somebody had reported that he died. And when you saw the look, the lumps and bruises and what on his face, you're saying to yourself, holy crap, this guy won the fight.
Well, that's true. One of the interesting pieces of that is that kind of hasn't been really written before was one of the people that I had interviewed for this book extensively was Joe's longtime companion, who was with Joe during those hours after the fight.
Was that Denise Menz?
Denise, yes.
Yes.
And she really reports that the kind of shape that Joe was in, he was terribly sick. And just imagine, his body had been I don't even know. I mean, pulverized,
yeah.
If you get right down to it. And Ali's was as well. And, you know, at the hotel, people were partying. They were partying for 3 days. Denise told me even the bellhops were drunk. You know, I mean, it was like an ongoing party. But Joe was just a wreck. And they did send him down to Philly, and he was in the hospital. Now, Gene Kilroy, who was one of Ali's people, gets a call. He's with Ali at a hotel in New York, and word is that Gene gets the word that Joe had died, and Ali was, you know, stunned. He said, "If that's true, I'll never fight again." And of course, it was just a rumor, but
no, pretty scary. And you know, we were talking about now. You know, some people will say, "Why did he take so much punishment?" But Yank Durham knew who was his first trainer, and then Eddie Futch, you know, came on board. But Durham knew at 5'11", and you know, his left hook was arguably, you could say, might have been the most devastating punch in all of boxing. I mean, it was it was a sledgehammer. I mean, you're right. I forget the guy's name, but in one of the fights, he literally knocked out somebody's wisdom teeth. Now that's not your front tooth. That's your wisdom tooth. Okay. I mean, and breaks jaws and this and that. But he just. But he was a short guy. He was 5'11", and Durham said to him, "If you're gonna do this, you gotta be in his chest. You can't be far away. You have to be in his chest," and that's how he fought his fights, all of
them. That's exactly right. Now, it's to Durham's credit that he brought in Eddie Futch in 66 or 67, I forget offhand. But early in the game, Durham didn't know Eddie. Eddie was out on the coast working with fighters in California, and he flew Eddie in, or actually they flew to California so Eddie could have a long look at Joe. They had a few fights, and if it were not for Eddie Futch, I don't think Joe would have been the fighter that he ended up being. I think Eddie was a brilliant tactician.
Yeah. Yank Durham died at 52, and then Eddie took over.
That's
as
right.
The main guy.
But Eddie was picking the fights,
right.
for even when Yank was alive. Eddie had a real eye for styles and who matched up with who, and you know, they avoided a lot of potential really tough spots by Eddie's smart the way he moved his fighter through this thing. And they avoided the elimination tournament. Remember back in the 60s, they had this elimination tournament to pick a champion.
Jimmy Ellis, who was an Ali sparring partner, ended up winning that tournament. He subsequently lost to, he got cold cocked by Joe.
Oh, my God. Well, you know, there was a lot of pressure on Joe to participate in that. And Yank Durham and Eddie said, well, you know, what's the point of that? You know, we're already highly ranked. And the ranking, the boxing organizations held it against them. They dropped him in the rankings, but people knew. I mean, Joe was a New York fighter. He was a house fighter at the Garden. You know, John Condon, who's the boxer?
Teddy Brenner.
Teddy Brenner, right? They had adopted Joe, and he fought quite a few of his early fights at the Garden, and he had a big following in New York, and so there really wasn't any point to him getting involved in that tournament.
Yeah, let's fast forward, just because I don't want to say dull, but of the three fights, the middle fight with Ali Frazier,
that was fought in a television studio.
Right? Yeah. But the thriller in Manila. And, you know, it's all legendary. And, you know, Ali saying he was close to death when it ended. And you know, people questioning, you know, why was the fight stopped? Because Ali was ready to quit. You never know. But the thing that struck me, and he was furious, just furious was Joe, that Eddie Futch would not let him come out for the 15th round. Just furious, and
he sure was.
And then you give us some information in the book, like, you know, Eddie Futch cared about his fighters, but you know he loved Joe, but also Eddie Futch saw seven guys die in the ring.
That's exactly right.
Oh my God, I got goosebumps just even repeating that to you.
Yeah,
he saw seven guys die in the ring, and listen, that was at a different time going back. And he wouldn't let Joe come out. That was it.
He liked Joe. He not only liked Joe. Joe had a family. He had beautiful children, and he had something to live for. And you know, it didn't make any sense to Eddie that he should imperil himself, because remember, Russ, Joe couldn't see out of either eye by the end. I mean, he had had for years. He had had problems with
people. Never knew the cataract. Yeah, that he had it in his eye. I think it was his left eye.
Have to check the text, but it was like one. He had congenital cataracts in one eye, and then his other eye was closed up just from damage. So he was actually he was feeling his way around the ring, trying to listen to how Ali was breathing, and so trying to find him by.
Can you imagine it?
Through hearing, and just they, you know, he and I don't buy the fact that Ali was ready to quit.
People say that. I tend to agree with you.
Yeah, Ali had said something later that he was going to quit, but I don't think in the moment. I don't think he would have. I don't think Angelo Dundee, his trainer, would have let him.
Yeah, the whole that as you say that trilogy, as people call it, you know, of Ali Frazier, you know, and of course there were so many other fights, you know, Foreman, the George Foreman fights. I think Joe Frazier was made to order for George Foreman.
Oh my God!
Really, you know, you've heard it say fighters are made for fighters. Like if you said to me today, I think if Ali and Norton fought. Although a bunch of times, they would always go to distance. It was just, there are styles for certain styles, and obviously Joe was made to order for a guy who was a bomber as well, who was bigger and stronger and taller.
Sure.
You know, very interesting. You know,
well, the first Foreman fight Joe had down in Jamaica with him when he lost the title.
Right.
He didn't have it. His head wasn't in it. I mean, it was a big family reunion down there. They were all sitting by the pool and having a good time. And Joe was running off to nightclubs, and he just wasn't. Eddie was looking at him in the gym, and Joe was training with Ken Norton, who at the time who was on the up, he was coming up, and Joe wasn't handling Norton very well. Yeah. And Eddie said, "What am I seeing in there? What am I missing?" And Norton told him he's just not himself. So, you know, it's he just wasn't ready for Foreman. And even if he had been, I think George would have handled him.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like you say, to me, there are fighters for fighters, and George was just, you know, too big and too strong and too tough.
I actually saw
the second fight at the Nassau Coliseum when he fought, when Frazier fought Foreman, and I'll never forget, he came out and he had the hood over his head.
Right.
And then
right.
he took off the hood, and there was this bald head, which you hadn't seen before, like, you know, but didn't do him any good because head got banged pretty good. The book is marvelous, but one of the things that really got me, and we can go on and on. Folks, I can tell you this. There are so many things that Mark Cram has in the book, including, listen, he loved women. He had 11 kids by a bunch of different women. He had his wife, Florence, who was married for years till they got divorced. He had, and it was almost like he had other families.
Yeah,
he always took the responsibility of making sure all those kids were taken care of.
He sure did. They didn't want for anything.
No. But so time goes on, and there was this famous thing meeting at the 2002 All-Star Game with Ali and Joe Frazier, where they were sitting together. But the night before the game, Ali's wife Lonnie invites Joe to dinner in their hotel suite, and he has Marvis, his son, who Marvis, you know, was a fighter at one point. Marvis was an ordained minister.
Yeah.
He already was. So they go up, and when they're leaving, well, I shouldn't even say this, not when they're leaving, but when they go walk in. And they see each other and they hug.
Yeah.
And Allie's crying on Joe's shoulder, and Lonnie said he's finally at peace now. I mean, I'm just getting choked up hearing that, because, you know, it was almost like, yeah, Allie realized what he did to Joe.
Well, you know, one of the questions I had for everyone I interviewed, Russ, was, you know, did Joe carry his grievances about Ali to his grave? I was, Joe in the 90s, he really was a very embittered man. There were a lot of things that he said that just, you know, it wasn't a good look for him, the way he just carried on this this grudge, what seemed to be a grudge. So I was curious about that. Did he put it to rest? Where did they put it to rest? Ali was always reaching out through third parties to sort of with an olive branch, but it wasn't good enough for Joe. He wanted Ali to come to a man-to-man.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it turns out, you know, I asked everybody, as I say, and some people who knew Joe for years said, there's no way that Joe ever let this go. You can't say to a man what Ali did to Joe and have it be forgiven. And now other people just as strenuously argued that Joe didn't have hate in his heart, that he was that he indeed let it go. And I think that the final scene in the book sort of puts an end to that discussion, don't you?
Oh, listen to me. I'm telling you, first of all, you kind of set it up, because it jumped off the page. This one thing jumped off the page at me, and if you will, it's real brief. I'm going to read it. When they were leaving the hotel suite, okay, Marvis, you know, Marvis suggested, let's all hold hands and say a prayer. And he's about to say a prayer when Joe says to Marvis, "I got this, son." And he goes on to say, "Dear Lord, we have forgotten and we have forgiven. Please heal this man because he has given so much to the world. And he has grandkids and babies. And it's time that he really can enjoy his life. So please do whatever you can to make this man right again."
Shoot. Yeah. I've got chills you just reading it.
Yeah, I'm telling you. No, I mean, it was like, whether Joe, and I kind of agree with you, I don't know if Joe ever truly forgave, but Joe was big enough to say, this guy's got his own problems now. This is the right thing to do, so I'm going to do it.
Well, yeah, that's right. We can't get inside Joe's mind, and you know, because his feelings about Joe always waxed and waned, didn't they?
No.
Mean, one moment he'd be going after him with a tire iron or threatening to, and the next minute they would be seen in public, doing some sort of promotional thing. It was hard to ever know really where Joe was with Ali at any given time. But it's my feeling that I think that scene and that that really sort of indicates where Joe's heart really was with this whole thing.
Yeah, I tend to agree. The book is Smokin' Joe: The Life of Joe Frazier, written brilliantly and beautifully by Mark Cram Jr. Mark, much success. I cannot thank you enough for being here. I could talk for hours and hours. just a wonderful job. Well done. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you.
All right, folks, and I want to thank all of you for listening, because that is now a wrap on today. So, again, thanks for getting a load of this, and now I'd like to get a load of you, so let me know your thoughts. You can let me know on Twitter at Russ Salzberg, on Facebook. You can also visit my website at russsalzberg.com. Thanks again to Mark Cram Jr. Thanks to the big man, Crash, who takes care of me, Mike Caragliano, Tim Einickel, the OG Podcast Network producer of mine, Dave Labrosi, 77 WABC program director, his outstanding assistant, Matt Dahl. And last but certainly not least, you guys and gals out there, because without you guys and gals, I'd have nobody here to be talking to. So until next time, it is I, Russ Salzberg, saying to everybody, bye-bye, so long, and farewell.